Good day. Today is Thursday, 19th February 2026. And before I proceed with this video, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this program, or whichever part of this program you want to watch, you decide that you like what you have heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Well, today I'm going to start with some news from my own country, from Britain, which is of the arrest and detention of the former British prince, the brother of the king, Andrew. He is nowadays referred to as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor because he was deprived of his two titles, Prince and Duke of York, some time ago. But I will call him Andrew. I find Andrew Mountbatten Windsor altogether too clunky, just to say. Anyway, I will call him Andrew. Anyway, we've just received earlier today news of Andrew's arrest and detention by the police in connection with a criminal investigation which has been brought against him on the charge or possible charge of misconduct of public office. Now, of course, as everyone knows, this event is clearly connected to Andrew's connections to the former financier, call it whatever you want, man of mystery, man of intrigue, serial sexual abuser, Jeffrey Epstein, who was for many, many years Andrew's close friend, or perhaps we should say that Andrew was his close friend. Now, I say all of this, the police have not confirmed that they have arrested Andrew, but we don't need to worry or concern ourselves about that, because the King, Charles III, has now published a statement which effectively confirms that Andrew is indeed the person arrested and is the person who is facing this case. Now, I don't want to spend an inordinate amount of time discussing this matter because we're still at a relatively early stage of these proceedings and there is an awful lot going on in the world, in Iran and in Ukraine, which I do feel I absolutely do need to discuss. But I am going to make a number of important observations. The first is the obvious one, which we should not forget or overlook, which is that Andrew, whatever we may think of him and whatever we feel about his connections with Epstein, nonetheless has a right, as everyone else does, to the presumption of innocence in any criminal investigation. So far as I am aware, he has not so far even been charged. He has certainly not yet been convicted of any crime. Maybe at some point he will be, but given that he is in the process of being held and detained and presumably at some point questioned by the police, I think it is even more important to remember that he is entitled to the presumption of innocence. I say that of every person who would find himself in the same situation as Andrew. The fact that he was a former prince and a member of the royal family makes absolutely no difference to me. It would be the same if it was some homeless person taken off the street. Well, that's the first thing I'm going to say. But now I'm going to say a few things about the case itself. Firstly, misconduct of public office is an extremely rare offence. It is very infrequently brought in Britain. The police very, very rarely like to pursue and prosecute it because the threshold of proving guilt is extremely high and very, very difficult to prove. Such cases usually take up a disproportionate amount of police resources. And, well, to say it mildly, In every case that I'm aware of or have had experience of, where a conviction was obtained, it was obtained entirely as a result of the confession of the investigated person. In every other case where a defence was brought, the police almost invariably ended up dropping the case. I'm not saying that is always true, by the way, but that's one thing I do want to say. The second is that this charge, well, it's not yet a charge, but this crime of misconduct of public office is the same crime for which the former disgraced ambassador to the United States and British cabinet minister and Labour Party politician Peter Mandelson is also being investigated for. Now, it is interesting because obviously both Mandelson and Andrew were friends of Jeffrey Epstein. We know for a fact, because it is hardly disputable, it is there in all of Epstein's emails, and I believe in Mandelson's emails as well. It is a fact that Mandelson provided advice, information, and documents to Epstein, originating from the very centre of British government. He provided advice through Epstein to JP Morgan, the US bank, to try to put pressure on the very same government that he, Mandelson, served, to try to get a change in British government policy during the 2008 financial crisis on bankers' bonuses, for example. So we know quite a lot about the kind of things that Peter Mandelson was up to. And given that he was a cabinet minister at the time, and given that he was undoubtedly abusing his position and breaching trust, and also, by the way, was receiving money from Epstein, and was trying to hold out via Epstein for a job at JP Morgan, the very bank that he was giving advice to on how to try to get a change in the policies of the British government. Anyway, given all of that, it is interesting that Mandelson has not, so far as I know, been arrested and has not been detained and has not been subjected to the same kind of searches as Andrew has been. Now, over the last week or so, there's been some information that Andrew did also provide important private information to Epstein. But the nature of that information is as yet unclear, and there's been far less information about this in the media in Britain. So it's interesting, it's very interesting that the police have come after Andrew so much more heavily up to now than they have come after Mandelson. Even though, so far as one can see, Andrew and Mandelson are being investigated for the same thing. I doubt, by the way, that this investigation of Andrew relates to any sexual activities. I would have thought that if that were the case, the crime investigated would be one of the sexual offences, not misconduct of private office. Just say. So that now brings me to the conduct of the police in Andrew's case, which is actually unusual. Firstly, it seems that Andrew has been, well, it just doesn't seem, Andrew has been arrested and he has also been detained. Now, that is unusual. In my experience, when individuals are being investigated by the police in Britain, even for very serious charges, the usual practice of the police is not to arrest them, but to invite them politely to an interview to assist in a police investigation. I know several cases where people have assumed that this is a polite inquiry and nothing to worry too much about, and have gone to these interviews, sometimes without lawyers with them, and have said all sorts of things which have as a result got them into very serious trouble. Any meeting with the police in Britain, as in any country, should be taken very seriously indeed. That's one piece of advice I'm going to give out now, by the way. And certainly, if you are invited to speak to the police, absolutely do make sure that you bring a lawyer with you. But anyway, put that aside. That doesn't seem to have happened in Andrew's case. The police did not invite him to attend an interview. So far as I can see from the media reports, what happened was that they rushed round to his house, whichever, wherever that is, and simply arrested him there. And they took him to the police station, and he's been locked up in a cell where he will presumably stay for 24 hours or 96 hours, unless, of course, over the course of this period of detention, he is charged, in which case the police might go to the British court and ask that he be held further in detention. Now, this is extremely unusual because, in my experience, the police only tend to do this for one of two reasons. One is that they think that unless the person is arrested, he will not turn up at any interview he's invited to attend, but will flee the country and place himself beyond the police's reach. So that is one instance when the police in Britain carry out an arrest before interview. The other, obviously, if they think that a crime, another crime, is about to be committed. Now, here I am going to express my guess. This is purely a guess, but I hear that several buildings associated with Andrew are being searched by the police. I wonder whether the police were given information that Andrew was trying to conceal or destroy incriminating documents, which presumably related to his involvement with Jeffrey Epstein. That is entirely a guess. I am not sure. So don't place any very great weight on that. But to arrest, detain, and carry out searches of an individual of the sort that, of any kind, before charge, is, in my experience, extremely unusual on the part of the police. And it strongly suggests to me that the police are indeed going to bring charges. They're going to accuse, in other words, Andrew of committing this crime of misconduct of public office very soon, probably within the next day or so. Anyway, that's my guess. To repeat again, for the moment, I don't know. But there is something else to say as well, which is that I have absolutely no doubt at all that before taking action of this kind against a member of the royal family, the police will have consulted with the Prime Minister and with the King. And in this case, it's clear that they were given the green light to act in this way by both the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, and by the King himself. The statement that the King has issued puts that as far as I am concerned, beyond any possible doubt. Now, I think it has been obvious to pretty much everybody for some time now, for several years now. In fact, ever since the king became king on the death of his mother, that relations between Charles and Andrew have completely broken down. That whether or not they were ever friends or loving brothers, they have ceased to be that long ago, probably, and they're certainly not that today. And perhaps it's worth adding that the king is not only apparently, well, not definitely, in fact, on very, very bad terms with his brother, indeed, to the point where he's prepared to let the police arrest his brother and hold him in a cell in the way that we now see, but that the king is also on very bad terms with his younger son, Harry, as well. So if you want evidence of a profoundly dysfunctional and unhappy royal family, well, it is there for you to see. But I cannot imagine that either the king or the prime minister would have given this sort of permission had there not been an overwhelmingly strong case, or at least an overwhelmingly strong case to answer, and if they weren't seriously concerned. So that is something else that leads me to think that we're probably going to see charges very soon. Now, what these charges are going to be, what the exact details of these charges are going to say, that I do not know. The fact that Andrew is being treated in this way suggests is very bad news for Peter Mandelson. And ultimately, it is bad news for the Prime Minister as well. But that is something I'm going to discuss later as events develop. It's also a massive blow to the British monarchy. It seems as if the second son of the former queen was behaving in a simply appalling way, a way that perhaps will lead to criminal charges. And it's difficult to imagine that the reputation of the monarchy is not going to be massively damaged. Already, just a few days ago, there was an incident where Charles was booed and hissed at by people in Britain, apparently angry with the royal family over the Epstein affair. So anyway, there it is. This may not look like a crisis outside Britain. I'm not sure that the royal family outside Britain is often taken extremely seriously. But it is worth pointing out again that in constitutional terms, Britain is still a monarchy. The king is the head of state. The prime minister is his first minister. The government is his government. The courts are his courts. Britain is not like some European states, which are essentially republics, but they have a hereditary ruler or president who is called a king. In Britain, the constitution is still deeply monarchical. And if this crisis shakes the monarchy, then it changes Britain. Anyway, that is all I'm going to say. We don't have much more information, and I don't want to devote, as I said, a huge amount of time to this topic, but I did want to say these things. Obviously, what is happening is very, very bad news for Andrew. I wonder quite where this is going to end, if he is sent to prison as a result of some kind of prosecution, which he could be. Well, then the consequences are going to be dire for the monarchy. And as I said, they will change Britain as well. So far as I know, apart from Ghislaine Maxwell, Andrew is the only associate of Epstein's that has been charged or detained by the police in this way up to now. And I wonder whether that is going to lead to other things, perhaps in the United States as well. Anyway, let's move on and let's discuss the other things that are taking place in the world. And one of the things we must start with is the continuing US build-up around Iran, which is becoming enormous. Yesterday, last night, I got messages from some of my American friends saying that people that are in the know are telling them that not only has the decision to attack Iran already been made, but that they expect that attack to happen within the next 48 hours. That was last night. So some of those hours have already passed. We haven't yet had an attack. There are reports in the media this morning that the US military have advised the president that they will be ready to carry out the attack on Iran on Saturday. Though some US officials, the Vice President JD Vance and the President's press secretary, are still saying that the president prefers a diplomatic resolution to the conflict rather than a military one. Well, we will see. Just a couple of days ago, I was discussing a meeting that took place last week between the president and Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel. Both the president and Netanyahu said afterwards that there were disagreements, that the president told Netanyahu that he was still looking for a diplomatic solution to the crisis, something that Netanyahu said to the Israeli media he was skeptical about the possibility of. Well, that was just a couple of days ago. Today, we are in a completely different position, and we are told, in effect, that war is coming. And again, I think one of the reasons why this momentum towards war has accelerated so radically over the last few hours is because of the fallout of the latest meeting between Araghchi and Witkoff in Geneva. Now, the Iranians are very unhappy about the way in which that meeting was conducted. I discussed that all in my program yesterday, with Witkoff going from one meeting with the Iranians to another meeting with the Ukrainians and the Russians, all in the same day. And the Iranians feel that this was a charade, not a real negotiation at all. But the reports that I'm seeing coming out of the United States suggest that some people in the administration, perhaps the president himself, have taken it otherwise and have also, in their own way, taken it very badly. That they were again expecting that Iran was going to fold over the course of this meeting, and that they were very upset and very angry when they found that Araghchi was sticking to Iran's red lines. And as often happens when things like this happen, when things like that take place, the president and his officials reacted very badly to this and started to rush forces to the Middle East and started talking again about military action. I should say that there do seem to be still some people who are saying that military action, though highly likely, the odds being placed now are that it is above 90% certain. Some people are saying that the Iranians still have until the end of this month to back down, and that an attack on Iran is more likely to take place in mid-March, which may suggest that we are still some 2 weeks away from that event. And it may be that this is connected to the fact that the Gerald Ford, the US supercarrier with its accompanying escorts, is still only is still off the coast of West Africa. It still requires several days before it can reach either the Eastern Mediterranean or the Arabian Sea, and that the attack will only come when the Gerald Ford is in position, and presumably after the Gerald Ford has been prepared for the attack. Well, that's what some people are saying, but nobody should place excessive reliance on that. But anyway, there might be, that might be one reason. That might be what might happen. It may be that there's been a decision to attack, but that it hasn't yet been made, and that some voices within the administration are still trying to pull back and saying, well, let's give the Iranians a few more days, either until the end of February or until March, mid-March. I think that putting aside the question of the movements of the Gerald Ford, there is perhaps another reason for the apparent urgency. And that is that the United States is gradually getting more and more information about the extent of Russian and Chinese support, military support for Iran. Now, again, this is extraordinarily difficult to plot because neither the Russian nor the Chinese governments are telling us anything about this, nor, by the way, are the Iranians either. And we are therefore completely dependent on rumours that are circulating. But the rumours speak not just of radar stations being supplied to Iran by China, but of very advanced radar stations operated by Chinese technicians, of both the Russians and the Chinese conducting extensive spying and all of that kind of thing, and of Russian jammers, and perhaps of air-to-air missiles and of ground-to-air missiles also being supplied by these two great powers to Iran. The greatest amount of physical help, it does now seem, is coming from China rather than Russia. Though, and both the Chinese and the Russians appear to be doing what they can in this very condensed situation to help Iran with its internal security problems. So that is also taking place, but there is something also taking place as well, which is that Russian and Iranian naval exercises have now begun in the Red Sea, but in the Indian Ocean, but they are now apparently also extending to the Arabian Sea, exactly the place where part of the US fleet, the USS Abraham Lincoln and its escorts, are located. There are already Chinese spy ships there, keeping an eye over the movement of these American warships. And though the Russian and Iranian warships that are involved in this exercise are, well, I mean, they represent a very small force indeed. I was going to come up with an even stronger word, but let's be polite, say a very, very small force compared to the gigantic armada that the United States has deployed. The thing is that it seems that over the next couple of days, Chinese warships are going to join this exercise as well. And though the combined Russian, Iranian, Chinese force will still remain extremely limited and very small compared to the force of the United States. China is today a naval power in some respects comparable to the United States, and the Americans will not want a situation where they find themselves in potential entanglement with any part of the Chinese Navy, especially so far away from the main area of conflict between the United States and China, which is, of course, the Taiwan Straits and the South and East China Seas. So it could be that it is the movement of these warships, limited, as I said, as it is, that is causing nerves to fray in Washington and has led to this dramatic stampede of additional forces. Supposedly 50 fighter jets were deployed to the Middle East, to the area, over the last 24 hours, and things of this kind. Of course, it could also be that this has been planned well ahead, and that the arrival of these Russian and Chinese warships is just a coincidence. But to be frank, I don't get the sense so. I think that there is an element of panic, well, not panic maybe, but anger and urgency on the American side that I haven't really noticed before. And by the way, given that I was just talking about the Chinese and American navies, again, I'm reading more and more reports, including another report that I read this morning, which is an American one, published, I think, in an American website, which basically said that with the Ford and its escorts present, the United States is going to have the best part of its deployable navy arrayed in the Arabian Sea, prepared to attack Iran. Of course, the bigger American navy is much larger, but many of these ships are in port, they're carrying out repair. The ability of the US to keep all its ships at sea has sharply reduced over the years. And, well, if anything happens to this force that has been deployed to the Arabian Sea now, if it suffers, were to suffer any significant damage, that would be in itself a significant military crisis for the United States. Well, anyway, that is what I've read. Maybe that is wrong, but that is what I have been reading for the moment. Anyway, I've also received further news about what various parties think the coming operation is going to look like. And again, this report comes from sources in Russia. I haven't spoken to these people directly, I should make that clear. I've received this information through a third party. But apparently the Russians are tracking large equipment, large supplies of weapons to Kurdish militia, who would be perhaps deployed in Iran as part of this operation. Some of the flow of these weapons is taking place through Azerbaijan and Iran. And the Russians and the Iranians are very, very concerned about it. And the Russians have been giving warnings to both the Armenians and the Azerbaijanians over this. And I discussed in a recent program that the Russians have prepared criminal cases against some of the leaders of these two countries, which they might decide to act on if there is a long war and these two countries do become involved on the American side. Just saying. But anyway, there's been a lot of discussion apparently about this. And well, taken together, the United States can see that Iran is being reorganized to defend itself, that it's receiving military aid now from China and Russia, that it's starting to take precautions, that it's being supplied with additional equipment, that there are Russian and Chinese ships in the area. So maybe there is a view starting to gain traction in Washington, one presumably shared by the president himself, that the moment to strike is now, because the window for a successful operation is closing, that if the US waits too long, if it waits a month or 2 or 3 months, by then Iran will have become sufficiently well organized and sufficiently well equipped by the Chinese and the Russians as to make an attack on Iran a disastrously risky and dangerous affair. Now, to repeat, there's an element of speculation on my part about all of this, but to say it again, it all makes sense to me, and I strongly suspect that I am right, just to say. Now, that, of course, then brings us back to a topic which I've touched on in the past, but I think I'm going to touch on again. Why this attack on Iran at all? The topic of the protesters, which dominated the headlines a month ago, well, that seems to have faded away entirely. The vice president, J.D. Vance, continues to say that it's all about Iran's nuclear capabilities and about the importance of preventing any risk of nuclear proliferation. But the president himself, after the June 2025 war, said that Iran's nuclear program, its enrichment capability, had been effectively destroyed. So is he telling us that all that information was untrue, or that he said that was untrue, or that the Iranians have been able to reverse all the damage in just a few months? We are given no explanation about any of this. There's been the issue of ballistic missiles, but Iran has had long-range ballistic missiles now for many years, over a decade, in fact, and it has only ever used them when it has itself been attacked. And one does not usually attack a country simply because it has an army with military forces that seem to be there mostly to defend it. So what is the pretext for this war? At this moment in time, Iran is not attacking anybody. The US and Israel have complained in the past about Iranian support for what they say are Iran's regional proxies, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the various Shia militias in Iraq, the Houthis in Yemen. But again, over the last year, following the various Israeli attacks on Hezbollah and the attacks on other Iranian proxies, we have been repeatedly told that the proxies have been so badly damaged, that Hezbollah has been so badly damaged, that they don't really pose much of a threat anymore. So it seems to me that there is an urgency about attacking a country that currently poses no threat at all, and that which is sitting down to negotiate about its nuclear enrichment program, and which is offering proposals, making proposals for consortiums and arrangements with the Russians, which would satisfy the proliferation issues that J.D. Vance says the United States is so worried about. There is a major difference between previous regime change operations in the Middle East and this one, which is that in the past, the United States has at least tried to present some kind of a case and has in each case sought to take that case to the UN Security Council. This is what they did in 2002 with Iraq, in 2011 with Libya, and in 2012 with Syria. This time, as far as I can see, there is no case at all, no serious attempt to create a case, and no reference or referral to the UN Security Council. Moreover, despite all of this, it's very strange, and I find it very disturbing, that there are so little protests and pushback from the Western publics about this particular operation. Back in 2002, there were enormous protests against the operation, the intended operation against Iraq. This time, when there's, as I said, no cases being presented at all, where there's not even been an attempt to take a case to the UN Security Council, well, it doesn't seem as if there's been any real attempt to carry out any real protests against what's about to happen whatsoever. And I do say, I do find this disturbing and baffling. Anyway, there it is. And this is the last, by the way, is despite the fact that I've been looking through the opinion polls in the United States, and I see that whereas in 2002, most Americans who were polled said they supported an operation against Iran, together today, in terms of the operation against Iran, which is about to happen, a clear majority now oppose it. Anyway, I said that the Russians have their ideas, or some people have their ideas, about how this operation is going to play out. The view that I'm hearing is that this time it is not actually going to be, at least the Russians don't think it's going to be, a decapitation strike like the one that was attempted during the June 2025 12-day war. Rather, the initial attack will be against the air defence systems. Once these have been suppressed by the stealth fighters and their cruise missiles, the heavy bombers, probably from places like Diego Garcia, will be unleashed and will bomb. Well, I'm not sure exactly what exactly. Anyway, I don't want to speculate too far, but all I will say is that all of the evidence now is that a war, a big war, is coming. Now, let's now move to the other major conflict that is taking place, one which is actually now starting to attract less attention, even though events in the conflict in Ukraine continue as before. Now, in my programme yesterday, I said that it's clear that the meeting in Geneva between the Russians, the Ukrainians and the Americans, despite some desperate attempts at positive spin from the Americans, didn't go at all well. Medinsky, the chief Russian negotiator, apparently straightforwardly restated all of the well-known Russian positions. Nuclear-free Ukraine, Ukraine outside NATO, Ukraine neutral, Ukraine non-aligned, no particular security guarantees for Ukraine, such as the Americans and the Ukrainians have been talking about. Demilitarization, denazification, and the entirety of the four territories transferred to Russia. There's been a further statements today by the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov. He has reinforced all of this, and he has said again that all of the objectives of the special military operation, as set out by President Putin on the 24th of February 2022, must be achieved. The Russians prefer to achieve them through diplomacy, but if they have to achieve them by continuing with the special military operation, then so be it. So the meeting didn't go well, and the Ukrainians came out of it extremely unhappy. And, well, I said yesterday that Zelensky has been complaining about the meeting and was complaining about the format of the meeting and is angry about the pressure the Americans have been putting on him and has said as much. I've seen more statements from Zelensky over the last few hours. It seems to me the man is falling apart. I was astonished at the incredibly foul and coarse language that he has increasingly taken to using, a clear sign that he is both extremely angry and under extreme stress. And, well, anyway, it's clear that the meeting didn't achieve any substantive progress, and I don't think anybody should expect that any future meeting will, unless the Ukrainians start to acknowledge that they have no real option but to start negotiating with the Russians upon the basis of the Russians' demands. Well, all of that was very clear about the meeting itself. But then something interesting happened. Interesting, but I should stress, by no means unusual in negotiations, which is that after the meeting, after the Americans had gone away, and that is interesting and suggestive, a second meeting took place without apparently interpreters present. And at that meeting, in a room, a locked room or a room with a closed door in the Intercontinental Hotel, only three people were present. These were Medinsky, the chief Ukrainian negotiator Rustem Umerov, and David Arakhamia, who is the leader, the parliamentary leader of Zelensky's party in the Ukrainian parliament. Now, the other thing about Arakhamia, which is important to remember in the context of this specific meeting, is that Arakhamia was the lead Ukrainian negotiator who dealt with Medinsky in 2022 and who negotiated with Medinsky the original Istanbul Agreement that the Russians and the Ukrainians initialed in Istanbul in April 2022. So you could say that this is a meeting of the three chief negotiators. Medinsky, who has always been the Russian chief negotiator, and on the Ukrainian side, their original chief negotiator, David Arakhamia, and their current chief negotiator, Rustem Umerov. Kirill Budanov, who has also participated in this meeting in Geneva, and who, according to media reports, is at odds with Zelensky and with Umerov, and who is willing to contemplate more extensive concessions to the Russians in order to end a war which is being lost. Anyway, Budanov was not apparently at this meeting. There were no note takers. There is no stenographic record. The meeting will have taken place in Russian, though I believe Medinsky does speak Ukrainian. He was born in Ukraine. But anyway, the meeting will have taken place in Russian, and there is no independent record of what took place. And none of the participants are telling us. Now, I ought to say that, again, I've been involved in many negotiations, and I can say from my own direct knowledge that it is not unusual. When negotiations take place, that after the parties have met in formal session, the chief negotiators meet with each other and talk things over with each other in order to see whether some way forward can be found. But given how the situation at the meeting in Geneva went, the fact that we appear to be at a standstill, I wonder whether that was the case here. I wonder whether the purpose of the meeting might have been for Medinsky to convey privately, in very forceful terms, to the Ukrainians, to Umerov and Arakhamiya, that the Russians are not going to make significant concessions, that the war is going to continue, that the Ukrainians should not be under any illusions that the Russians are going to concede anything in this way, and that if the Ukrainians don't start to shift and start to take the Russian demands seriously, the outcome will be very, very bad for them. If that is what did indeed take place at this meeting, then the meeting would have been in the form of an ultimatum being delivered by Medinsky to Ukraine's chief negotiators, effectively an ultimatum, rather than a follow-up negotiation. And in that case, I suspect that the meeting was probably rather heated and acrimonious, which may explain why allegedly it lasted something like 2 hours. That is my guess. It's the best explanation for this meeting that I can find up to now. To reiterate once more, meetings of this kind do happen in negotiations. Nothing perhaps over dramatic should be assumed by it, but it is interesting that the Russians and the Ukrainians, the chief negotiators on each side, are talking in this way with each other. As I said, I do think more likely than not, the Ukrainians were presented with some sort of ultimatum, perhaps, and very plausibly, a message to be taken to Zelensky himself, a message sent to Zelensky, perhaps by Putin, which Medinsky was conveying. And perhaps, and could it be, that one of the reasons Zelensky is so angry, one of the reasons why he is using this unbelievably coarse and crude language littered with foul words, is because he is extremely upset to be receiving messages from the Russians like that. Well, all speculation on my part, and I say this straightforwardly, but then why not? As I said many times, this is my programme, and it makes sense, as far as I can see, of all that we know, which is going on. In the meantime, the war continues. And we've had further news from the battlefronts. Firstly, it is increasingly looking as if the Ukrainian offensive in Zaporozhye has not only run out of steam, but might indeed be going into reverse. There's been more Russian advances east in eastern Zaporozhye towards Orekhov. And last night, there were reports that the important village of Ternovata, captured by the Russians at the beginning of this month, a village which apparently the Ukrainians, it was one of their major objectives to recapture over the course of this latest counterattack, that Ternovata remains firmly under Russian control. There's speculations that the Ukrainians recaptured it, and then that the Russians again immediately recaptured it. I don't know. I was not there. I am not able to say. Just saying. But anyway, for the moment at least, it does seem as if Ternovata is indeed back under Russian control, or is under Russian control. There are also reports that Ukrainian resistance in Gryshino, this key village to the northeast of Pokrovsk, is ending, and that the Russians now control most of it, almost all of Gryshino, and are indeed actually now starting to advance north of Gryshino as well. We will see whether the Russian Ministry of Defense confirms this. But perhaps again, and to repeat, the biggest news comes from from Konstantinovka, where the Russians are continuing to storm the town, and where Ukrainian resistance does definitely appear to be crumbling. There isn't, as I understand it, even much in the way of denial from the Ukrainian blogging community any longer that this is the case. We are still waiting for the next big Russian strike on Ukraine. It may come at any point within the next couple of hours or days. The Russians obviously decide their own time. They follow their own clock. But I have no doubt that before long, a big attack will come. Before I finish today's programme, let me comment on one last issue. Yesterday, Putin himself met the foreign minister of Cuba, who is now in Moscow, or has been in Moscow. And I ought to say that it is unusual for Putin to meet with foreign ministers one-to-one in his Kremlin office. Mostly visitors that Putin meets are either presidents or prime ministers, people, in other words, with equal status to himself. But this time, Putin did agree to meet with a foreign minister. And Putin gave strong words of support for Cuba. He said that relations between our countries are special and have been forged through history. We have always stood by Cuba in the struggle for its struggle for independence, for the right to pursue its own path of development, and we have consistently supported the Cuban people. We understand the immense challenges that the Cuban people have faced over the years, over the decades, indeed throughout the decades of Cuba's independence, in their fight for their right to live by their own rules and to defend their national interests. We are now witnessing a particular period marked by new sanctions. You know our stance on this. We reject such measures outright. The position of our Ministry of Foreign Affairs is clear, unequivocal, and has been articulated openly. There was no reference, however, in this meeting to Russia supplying Cuba with oil, though there's no reason to think that those discussions aren't taking place. But anyway, there was this meeting between Putin and the foreign minister of Cuba. But alongside that, there were reports that were circulating yesterday on the internet, which it must be said have now been denied in both Cuba and the United States. There were reports claiming, to be precise, that I believe the son, or maybe the grandson, of Raul Castro, who is still alive, Fidel Castro's brother, He is still Secretary General of the Cuban Communist Party, and therefore, in fact, number one in Cuba, even though he is now a very old man. I believe he's in his 90s. Anyway, there were reports that the US is having private discussions with this younger Castro, and it's not exactly clear what, if any, role in the Cuban government this younger Castro actually has. I've seen him described as a bodyguard for his father. Anyway, just to say. But apparently, or supposedly, or allegedly, the United States considers this younger Castro representative of the more pragmatic, open-minded faction within the Cuban leadership, the ones who would be more interested in doing a deal with Cuba, with the United States, a deal whereby, in effect, Cuba dismantles its economic and political system, and, as far as I can tell, accepts the tutelage of the United States. Now, I'm going to say straight away, I don't know whether there is actually a dialogue between the United States and this particular person. And I don't know whether there's any kind of dialogue between Cuba and the United States at all. I think it is likely that there is. Though I don't know this for a fact. If a dialogue is indeed happening, then inevitably one has to ask the question whether, for the Cubans, the most important issue is not help from Russia or help from China, but coming to some kind of deal with the United States. That they might be sending their foreign minister to Moscow to speak with the Russians, but the real business is being done with the Americans. I have to say that if that is so, it would not surprise me. The Cuba of Fidel Castro was a very disciplined government and, in some ways, society. I am not sure that today's Cuba, which of course has experienced mass tourism, multiple contacts with the West, where the internet is easily accessible, or at least is accessible, I don't know whether it's easily accessible. I'm not sure whether today's Cuba is the same place. Anyway, I don't know, just saying. But it was clear a couple of days ago that the Russians were indeed offering Cuba oil. And it was also clear a couple of days ago that China was sending supplies of rice to Cuba and is now also providing Cuba with solar panels to provide Cuba with electric power. And Cuba is an obvious place, by the way, to use solar power. It is, after all, a tropical country, so there is sunshine, bright sunshine there all around the year, just saying. Anyway, but it still seems to me as if the Cubans, for all the fact that their foreign minister is going to Moscow and is talking to the Russians, they still don't seem to be grappling or addressing the possibility of some kind of deal with the BRICS states. They seem to be, and I wonder whether it could be that they're still looking to make a deal with the Americans instead. If that is the intention, then I'm going to say straight away that I think that is a mistake. I think that the Cubans underestimate how extremely implacable towards Cuba the American government, particularly this American government, is. Anyway, we shall see how it plays out. So this is where I'm going to finish my program today. Obviously, we're now all waiting for what will happen next in terms of the United States and Iran. The situation is extremely tense. At the Duran and on this channel, we will obviously cover the story as it develops. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Please remember also to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.